Okay. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Wednesday, April 1st, 2015. I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government, opening a public hearing on House Bill 5021 relating to the Governor's Office. Minister Hill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. The Office of the Governor is had a couple of issues in the last biennium that this committee in particular was trying to address, and one of them was borrowed positions from other agencies, both that are either literally borrowed and budgeted in other agencies and or work in the Governor's Office, and positions that actually work in the Governor's Office budgeted there but have funds that are transferred from other agencies to fund those positions. They came in a couple of times and reported that they were going to address that situation in the current budget. And when the agency request budget was submitted, that issue was not addressed. So that was an issue. Probably the bigger issue, of course, with this agency is that that administration is no longer in the Governor's Office, and it's a whole different situation. You know, with the turnover, I have met with the Chief of Staff, Brian Shipley, and we've had some discussions. Obviously, they have some major issues that they're trying to take care of. And so as we go forward, we can talk about timing of the budget and some things. I think they've had some discussions with members of this committee also. So with that, I'll turn it back over to you.
Great. Thank you very much. Mr. Shipley, Mr. DeForest, and anybody else you'd like to have come join you.
Thank you very much, Madam Co-Chair. I'm Brian Shipley, Chief of Staff in the Office of the Governor. I've had a chance to meet with some of the members of the committee and look forward to meeting with the others to soon to answer any questions and also receive any input that that folks have for Governor's Office. What we thought made sense today was for me to do just a very quick overview of the mission and function of the Governor's Office for you, and Brian DeForest, who's joining me here from Department of Administrative Services, can walk you through more details about positions and numbers and so forth. But we're happy to answer any questions that you all have. So just to give you an update on what we have been up to, as you know, Governor Brown was sworn in on February 18th. And out of the gate, our primary goal and focus has been to establish some stability and for her to make the changes and moves necessary to beef up and functional, which means, you know, leading the executive branch in engaging with the legislature during the course of the legislative session. And then number two, to start working towards one of her biggest priorities, which is to restore some public confidence in state government, which means doing the things that she is doing at the start as transparently as possible, which has led her to some of the early decisions that she has made. We established a policy advisor position in the Governor's Office for the first time ever, dedicated to ethics and public records policy. And as you know, in the legislative process, that we are working on some proposals to move the state forward there. Another big part of our workload out of the gate has been focusing on the existing public records requests that have come into the Office of the Governor. We brought temporarily on four additional attorneys from the Department of Justice to help us work through the backlog of public records requests. Just since October 2014, the Governor's Office has received over 200 separate requests for public records. 45 of those requests have come in since February 18th, you know, on top of what was already pending when Governor Brown took office. In total, between the subpoenas for investigations and the records requests, we are currently processing over a million public records, both emails and other documents, and trying to push as much out as quickly as possible.
Senator Johnson.
One of the things that I have asked episodically, but you present as a target of opportunity to ask to have this more standardized, is are agencies keeping track of the costs that they are incurring in terms of managing these requests and what it's taking in AG time to do appropriate redactions? Because agency by agency, some are going to get hit harder than others given the engagement of the previous administration, but are they keeping track of it? That's question number one. And question number two is, are you working on the oldest of the requests first, or is there some queuing? Because I am told by papers in my district that they have had record requests in for a really long time with no action at all. And I would love to know how you're triaging the requests.
Thank you, Senator Johnson, Madam Co-Chair. On your first question, are agencies keeping track? The answer is as best we can tell, different across the agencies, which is one of the reasons that Governor Brown is proposing and introducing legislation here shortly to direct the Secretary of State to audit public records. And the biggest focus of that audit is on the process side of public records, so identifying best practices, identifying costs and legal fees associated, and so that we have that information and can react and decide how we want to move forward.
I must not have asked my question artfully enough.
Yeah.
I am asking, are you waiting for legislation to begin this, or if, just pick an agency, ODF and W, and I just picked them, if they have expended 50 hours already in combing through records, is somebody keeping track of that expenditure, bill notwithstanding? These are real costs that the agencies are incurring, in some cases to the detriment of their core business operations.
Senator Johnson, Madam Co-Chair, no, there is not a concerted effort right now to statewide tally those costs, but that is something that we've been talking about and that we need to do so that you and we have an understanding of what the impact of this is and the impact of any potential policy changes that the legislature might want to make in the future. I mean, your point is well taken. And
I would submit to you that record monetized would be Exhibit A in why we needed best practices to respond to these requests.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll go back and look at what data is available.
And I still need you to talk about triaging, what goes when.
Yep.
Well, can I just ask a quick follow-up to the cost question?
You're Senator, the chair. You can do whatever you want.
Well, no. I want to make sure that you get to know. I know, but I respect the question you ask, and I didn't want to imply that Mr. Shipton wouldn't answer your question. But I just want to clarify. I thought when people submitted public records requests that one of the first things they got back was a cost estimate. Does that cost estimate not include the kinds – I mean, how are those cost estimates generated? Maybe you don't even know the answer, and it depends from agency to agency, which gets right back to Senator Johnson's statement.
They make it up.
Did we?
Senator?
I didn't hear that.
Go ahead.
I get,
the answer is you're right. I'm not the expert.
Okay.
I mean, to answer the question, but we can do some digging for sure.
I guess it's not necessarily to you, but actually, Mr. DeForest, to DAS, the point that's one of the things I think we need to be thinking about. If we are preparing cost estimates, how are those estimates being arrived at? What inputs are being included in terms of time and effort and taking away from our core mission to make sure that, I mean, believe me, I'm a big fan of openness and transparency, but I'm also not a big fan of using taxpayer dollars to satisfy a request that should be paid for by the person requesting it to a large extent. So I think that's probably, unless you have something to add, Mr. DeForest.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian DeForest from the Chief Finance Office. Kind of answering some of the nuances in your statement, Madam Co-Chair, is it can vary from agency to agency. I've worked in five different agencies, and there are some slight differences. We as agency folks do try to capture the actual cost, the cost of an employee's time to do the research, compile, and then the obvious costs. This is how much it costs to copy paper or provide a disk or transmit that information over to the agency. At DAS, when we have such large, voluminous records requests such as this and all of the other activity that are added onto it, we do try to capture the total cost statewide and provide as much consistency across the agencies as possible. In this case, some of it may be focused on a couple of different agencies. And then we work with the Legislative Fiscal Office to make sure that we're transmitting the methodologies that are used and if there are any funding mechanisms that we have to have a discussion between the two offices.
Thank you. Senator Johnson, your question about triage.
Senator Johnson, Madam Co-Chair, the answer is complicated by the legal situation that we find ourselves in. There's a lot of overlap between the federal investigations and congressional subpoena that we are facing and the content of a lot of the records requests. And there are places where, given the grand jury proceeding that is going on, there is material that we can't turn over, that the courts won't let us turn over, that frankly Governor Brown would turn over as quickly as possible, and will once we get that all clear. So in general, the direction that Governor Brown has given to legal counsel in processing the public records is to move as quickly as possible to, as you suggested, clear the oldest requests first, but also clear as much low-hanging fruit as possible as well, because all of these records have to be reviewed for privilege and security and private personal Oregonian data, and that's why we brought in the extra attorney power to move through it as quickly as possible. And I think you'll see even just in the next few days a lot of records coming being released.
Thank you.
Did you have a follow-up, Senator? Okay. Senator Whitson?
Thank you. Actually, two questions. Mr. DeForest, charges for public records requests are dependent upon the public benefit of that request. So how are you determining the public benefit of exposing the inside of some of the scandals that have been going on the last couple months?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, when I'm calculating the cost of providing a public record, first we have to evaluate, is the record in fact public? Is it subject to other confidentiality?
I understand that, Mr. Forrest. What I'm saying is that there is, whether you're charged for a public record or not, depends on whether it is the degree of the public benefit of the disclosure of that record.
I focus... Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, the focus is really more on the cost of generating the public record itself. In some cases, when I'm providing information to the public, if it's a matter of me looking into a spreadsheet and pulling up a number or maybe printing off a single sheet of paper, there is no cost. It may take me 15 minutes, and we certainly wouldn't charge for something like that. If it's an effort where we have to comb through thousands of documents. So, for example, when I was a temporary director of an agency, we had to comb through 500 documents in order to generate all of the information for the request. We ended up billing out the actual cost of the hours of the people involved, not just me, but the administrative staff as well. And we try to limit it to just to the actual cost of that generation, not to the value of that record being out in public.
Let me follow up on that. As an example, I have asked for a public records disclosure from a particular individual in the Department of Justice. After a couple of weeks, I received my attorney received a response that it would cost X much. However, because of the public benefit of that disclosure, that I would only be charged less than half that much. That was the genesis of my question. How do you determine whether it's in the public benefit, whether you charge them or you don't charge them?
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I'm not familiar with that model, so I would have to get back with you on that.
Okay. Senator Senator Whitsitt, on that point, so that is actually another of those variables that we've discovered as we've dug into this, that where there is an inconsistent interpretation of that question across state government and even over time in given agencies. So we want to look into that.
Okay, I'll have to go back and read the statute. I didn't think it was too unclear. But
the definition of public benefit.
Yes. Well, that's what I was asking. Yes, okay.
Right.
And the second question, please, is for Mr. Shipley. Within hours of the time that the governor was sworn in, it got busy.
It's less than hours.
Two senior executives at DAS were put on executive leave. A criminal investigation was initiated. And within a couple of days, the director of DAS either resigned or was fired. What's going on there?
Senator Whitsitt, on the advice of counsel, I cannot comment today on an ongoing criminal investigation, which is ongoing today. And I wouldn't comment on the personnel action that was taken at DAS involving those two individuals being placed on leave or the resignation of the chief operating officer today. At a future time, I will be more than happy to be fully transparent and explain to you everything that legally I can explain to you.
Okay, I respect that. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian, just a follow-up. Are we anticipating a possible report in 6 months or 16 months, or is there a timeline attached to Senator Whitsitt's question?
So I can tell you that the criminal investigation the interview phase of the criminal investigation is coming to a close, and the agency, State Police, is moved into report writing, and I believe that we will see a report here in the next few weeks.
Thank you.
And that the investigation will be over, and I'll be able to answer more of yours and Senator Whitsitt's questions.
Appreciate your professionalism and your response.
Thank you. Representative Senator Johnson.
It does, though, and again, I will respect it if you don't respond, but it does beg several questions. You act as though there's, or commented as though there's only one investigation. Are you at liberty to say how many there are? There are questions about how material ended up on servers. There are a variety of different activities, and I don't know how they intertwine. Have they been consolidated in some way? Or?
Senator Johnson, Madam Co-Chair, on the advice of counsel, I probably shouldn't talk to you
That's
about the details of tactics, but I assure you that this will be transparent in a matter of weeks, not months.
Thank you.
Okay. If there are no further questions, you may continue with slide one.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So the other thing that most of what I was describing to you, and we don't need to go in depth in a lot of the other slides that are in your packet, I'll share a couple of other things before turning it over to Mr. DeForest. So I talked about short term. Governor Brown's goals have been to get functional, get ready to lead the executive branch in engaging with the legislature while it's in session, and to do it as transparently as possible in dealing with the backlog of public records requests and the ongoing federal and state investigations. Longer term, and this is a conversation that Governor's office has been having with LFO and with the co-chairs of this subcommittee, we are are hoping that this committee will help us in these first urgent moments of the Brown administration to keep the budget stable. But we commit to coming back to you with a plan for any changes or any new factors that emerge, whether it's structural and staffing changes that Governor Brown sees as necessary for the longer term, whether it's costs associated with the public records requests and investigations, as well as I want to be sure to tell you to address appropriately And I don't know what that means without more back and forth with the committee. The issue that Mr. Hill raised, we're very aware that the Governor Kitzhaber's administration was in front of eBoard in May 2014 reporting to you on the issues of borrowed positions and fund transfers. And once upon a time in another role, I was involved in helping to clear up and make the committee more comfortable with some of those same issues. So that is on our radar screen and on our agenda. And when we do eventually come back to you with a clear recommendation for governor's office budget, we plan to address that stuff with you.
Certainly, Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I hope, Mr. Shipley, that includes the use of vacancies as well. I think many of us were shocked to see that Mr. Carroll on the former administration's staff was being paid $165,000 a year, if one can believe the reports in the newspaper. And when I did some inquiring about that, I was told that it was the use of vacant positions. So I hope that it includes the vacancies.
Thank you.
Slide two.
So, as you all know, the primary mission of the Office of the Governor is to provide leadership for the executive branch of government, of Oregon State government. And if you click to the next slide, what you will
actually
see,
go back to that slide
sure,
for 1 second,
sure.
Mr. Shipley. I'm interested in the way that you frame the superintendent of public education issue. And I don't disagree that the governor should be that, especially for the moment. But I've long thought about how we've been structuring education in this state and about how we construe education in silos. I know that we've made efforts over the past several years to start to deconstruct some of those silos. And I appreciate the fact that you're framing his cradle career, but at some point, and I'm sure it's too early in Governor Brown's administration, but I personally would be very interested to hear about her perspective about what I like to call lifelong learning. I've often wished that instead of the Higher Education Coordinating Committee and OEIB, that we had the Department of Lifelong Learning for Oregon, because I think that to assume that people stop learning once they're in a career is a false assumption and not good for Oregon's long-term well-being and Oregonians' long-term well-being. And that's more of a statement than a question, but I wanted to put it on your radar since that position was on your slide.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
And Madam Co-Chair, can I just say,
please,
just briefly on that point, we talk about how new this is and how fast we're moving, but Governor Brown has made the principles of that seamless lifelong learning, not that she's used that terminology for it, a very big priority. And Governor Brown's administration has been working closely with Senator Roblin and the workforce or the work group work that is being done around structure so that there may be some short-term changes that the legislature in conjunction with the governor want to make, but also I think that's going to be an ongoing conversation for the administration over the next year as well, so that we get it right. She doesn't want to rush at restructuring everything again without knowing.
I look forward to participating in those conversations. Senator Johnson, Senator Whitsitt.
I might just make this observation, and it might be purely my opinion, but I think that in the previous administration, there were so many changes happening so quickly in the education realm that it was enormously difficult for stakeholders to keep up with what was going on. And if they can't keep up, they can't be invested. And if they can't be invested, they're disengaged or hostile. And as you wrestle with what to do with education now that it is in a new administration's portfolio, I just share my experience in my district of being pretty connected up with the schools and realizing how little people understood all the acronym alphabet soup that existed and what they were supposed to do in terms of delivering quality education for our kids.
Thank you. Oh, Senator Whitsitt, yes, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Along that same line, the cradle to grave is cradle to career is a good slogan, but the effort seems to be focused on early learning, and I don't necessarily disagree with that, but we seem to be doing that instead of investing in the kids that are in school now, in the middle school and high school. We are dead last in high school graduation. Our CTE, our vocational studies, are just frankly pitiful, the effort. Our attendance in schools are terrible, and we know that the attendance is inversely proportional to graduation rates. Those kids who are graduating, 40%, between 40 and 45% of the kids who graduate from high school when they present themselves to a community college require remedial education in English arts or math or both before they can start. Our schools are failing, and yet we're not addressing those kids that are there. Are we going to throw away the generation, or are we going to do something about it? And I don't expect an answer. That was my little preaching for the moment.
Mr. Shipley, I'm sorry. You're with understandably, you're getting a lot of questions that aren't really relevant to your budget presentation. That's okay. The committee has leeway, and you're being very patient with us, and I appreciate it. Other questions before we keep going? All right.
Okay, and this slide is just to tell you that coming from that mission of leadership for the executive branch, the staffing of the governor's office to support the governor in meeting that mission reflects the span of policy issues that state agencies confront and the work that executive branch agencies do throughout state government. The staffing also supports the governor in the governor's role as a convener of other stakeholders, local, public, private, sector collaborations, whether that's a particular project in a particular community, or that's a broader policy issue that state government is confronting. The staffing, of course, also includes the administrative functions like communications and legal and constituent services that are necessary for the function of the governor's office, and also support the role of the governor as the face of the state of Oregon, as the representative of the state of Oregon with the federal government, with local governments, with other states and nations, as well as our tribal partners in government. Then the last three slides in my section highlight the kind of three big policy priorities that Governor Brown has set forth as she has gotten started. We don't need to go into any details, but just so that you're aware, as we discussed, education and investment in early learning is a major priority for Governor Brown, along with investment in career technical education and STEM programs. She also is focused on college affordability and investment in the Opportunity Grant, particularly making sure that it is focused on getting aid and access for the highest need individuals in the system, and support some of the work that the Higher Education Coordinating Commission has been doing around that subject. Next slide, she also is putting a focus on jobs and continuing to grow Oregon's economy. The focus continues to be on recruitment of new businesses into the state, but at the same time also reemphasizing our commitment to growing our own jobs, facing the reality that 70% of new jobs going forward will be created in Oregon, companies that are already in existence and in Oregon, and from their growth, there's a lot that we can do internally as well, and we'll continue to move forward with that agenda.
Co-Chair Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. It's great seeing you here. One of the things I just want to point out, not necessarily a question, is I hope we could take the message back that the Port of Portland is one of those tools that we have accessible to us, but I'm not, especially in our mission to develop global trade and exports, mm-hmm. but I'm not convinced, as a person who represents four upriver ports, that we're fully utilizing the Port of Portland the way we should. Mm-hmm. And I'd point out that the governor is responsible for the appointments to that commission. And I know there has to be a balance. I thoroughly understand that. But I'm not sure we're fully utilizing an economic development tool that could really stimulate the state's economy. And that's all I'll say on that.
Do you want to comment at all before? Okay, Senator Whitson.
Thank you. Following up on Co-Chair Smith's line of questioning, the Port of Portland has been slowed down, hamstrung by the longshoremen and clerks and walking bosses and so forth, who, according to my figures, are making anywhere from $120,000 to $300,000 a year, not including OPE. That is having a huge negative effect across the state, not just, you know, and certainly Hengen moving out is, but just as an example, we have a fledgling company in Southern Oregon who are set up to do an organic potato packing deal. They have a crew sitting there, it has been sitting there for a month and a half, waiting to install the equipment, which is on a container somewhere off the port of Long Beach. The next port of call for that crew is in Saudi Arabia. Meanwhile, there's millions of dollars worth of potatoes sitting there that are getting older by the day. That's just one example of what's going on. This is huge. I don't know what the governor can do, and maybe you can help us with what the governor can do. I know it's a National Labor Relations Board deal. It's an international corporation. But it is killing the economy in this state. It is huge.
Yep.
So could you address that?
Yeah, thank you, Senator Whitsitt, Madam Co-Chair. We will look into that particular case. I'm not familiar with the details yet, but we'll get back to you and want to learn more and see if there's something that can be done. I know Governor Brown would want to do it and deal with the potatoes before they rot.
Senator Johnson.
I'm struck by the three main agencies in the jobs and economy portfolio. Business Oregon, I easily understand. DOR and DCBS, I get those too. But one of the things that I think I would like to offer up for your consideration is, in order for jobs in the economy to flourish, the regulatory environment, any required changes that we need to make in land use, the question about whether one size fits all for all of Oregon, I would submit that there are a number of other agencies that fit within that gravitational pull that might be germane to moving us forward. So often in more rural parts of Oregon, where we're faced with the inability to aggregate land because of the easy standing to bring suit, even by people who don't live in the county, it's confounding. And those of us that represent rural places see opportunity just slipping through our fingers. So I would respectfully ask that perhaps that jobs and economy portfolio be broadened in your internal discussions to see what else facilitates companies not only wanting to stay here and expand, but certainly come.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. May I,
please.
Madam Co-Chair?
Please.
You are absolutely right. And as you
can't say that again. I just love hearing it.
It's been a relatively regular occurrence this year, Senator.
But as you're intimately familiar, I mean, this is the highest of the high-level slide,
yeah.
And you know that in the work of the regional solutions teams is reflected a much broader set of agencies, DLCD and DEQ and so on, and Governor Brown remains absolutely committed to regional solutions and the good work on the ground out in all parts of Oregon on that stuff.
Thank you. That's comforting. That's good. Thanks.
We good?
Yes,
okay.
Please.
Oh, sorry, Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. The good Mr. Shipley will decline our invitation next time, perhaps. But following on Senator Johnson's line of questioning, we also have a water use planning program coming forward. And the plan appears to be to leave as much water as possible in stream and in the ground, which is completely counterproductive to agriculture and in many places industry. That's true of several of the state agencies. I need not enumerate them. I would hope that we could have a robust discussion on the direction that we're going, the damage that is causing rural Oregon, and how we might rectify that.
Thank you, Senator Whitsitt, Madam Co-Chair. I can't comment, not on advice of counsel, just because I don't know yet. I can't comment on the specific water use planning process that I know has been underway. But I do appreciate you flagging water, which, again, is another of the governor's early natural resources and economic development priorities and the proposals around investing both in the Umatilla Storage Project as well as funding getting grants throughout the state is very important to her and something that she will advocate for. In the short term, we will also look into this longer-term trend that you are
just to follow up, and full disclosure, Representative Whitson and I had a full hour meeting with the governor a couple of weeks ago on that issue. So she is responsive, certainly.
Well, I appreciate you getting it out of the record publicly too, Senator. Senator Johnson.
I also would like to commend the governor for her commitment. As I understand it, she has already traveled to Hermiston or Pendleton.
Pendleton
to see that Umatilla project. I've had the opportunity to be out there on the ground with colleagues. We flew some urban legislators out to take a look at it and get briefed. That is an incredibly important project, and I think her early acknowledgement of its importance by making that one of her first trips should be part of the public debate. I applaud her for doing that, and I think it sends an incredibly important message to Eastern Oregon.
Thank
the
you,
whole state, not just Eastern Oregon, the whole place.
And she's been to Bend. She's going to Medford next week. She's down in Albany today touring the school. Senator Johnson, Madam Co-Chair, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate what's happened in Albany today.
It is really unfortunate.
I don't know if people are school aware of this. The Albany High School burned down today. And that's why Senator Gelser had to leave early. She went with the governor down to Albany.
Yes. I'm sorry, Madam Co-Chair.
No.
I was going to say, both Senator Gelser and Representative
yes.
Olson
went
with the governor and are down there at South Albany High School right now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's a big, and in that community, it's particularly problematic. Not that that wouldn't be no matter what, but that's the cafeteria that prepares meals for most of the schools in the Albany School District. So it's a really significant, has a huge impact on the entire school community there. And it's, you know, high schools are important to communities. So I'm grateful to Governor Brown and Senator Gelson, Representative Olson, first.
I assume there are no injuries?
No injuries. It happened early
that's
this
right.
morning.
Early
morning hours. I mean, and so that's a blessing. And there are some questions. There were some other incidents nearby. So I'm sure that the state police and the fire people and all their usual folks will be investigating, but it's a really unfortunate circumstance. It's all of us who've had high schools in our communities know when they go south, it's a really big impact on our community. So, all right.
So I'll wrap up with the next slide. I won't go through it. We've spent quite a bit of time unless there are other questions about the proposals around ethics reform and public records and I'm happy to answer any other questions and also can turn things over to Mr. DeForest.
I think we're good. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I get the fun part. I get to talk about all of the numbers.
Treja.
As you recall, a couple of years ago, we talked about the history of the expenditures inside of the governor's office. During the 2011-13 biennium, this wasn't just the core governor's office as you would normally think about it, but also included education programs that had the early learning that had come over from the Commission from Children and Families, also the youth development programs. OEIB was created during the 11-13 biennium, and it existed in the governor's office. So to compare oranges to oranges, we prepared the next slide to really just focus on the core governor's operations themselves. Over the course of the three biennium, they've grown from 53.5 FTE up to 57.5. General fund alone has grown from 9.8 up to 11.4 and then 11.6 in the governor's budget that was published, and then lottery funds squeezed in between there from 1.8 million up to 3.4 and then 3.8 million after that.
Senator Johnson.
give examples of the lottery fund expenditures, if you would.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, lottery fund is solely expended inside of the Regional Solutions Program itself.
Okay.
And this is primarily the staff of the Regional Solutions folks into the 11 different regional areas. Each one of them has their own region itself. This would not include any of the bonded capacity that would come through the Business Oregon folks, but really just Regional Solutions proper.
Thank you. I that was helpful. I happen to be the convener for one of those regions, so I understand how it works, but I was just trying to differentiate what you were doing, and the personnel is the answer. Thank you.
Thank you.
As you would expect in an office such as the governor's office, it is primarily personal services. I'm really glad that that didn't show up in the slide. So I'll read it for you. $14.1 million in the governor's budget for personal services. That's 76% of the total expenditures for the office. The remainder is services and supplies, $4.4 million of total fund, or 24%, about the type of percentage that we would look to see in an office that is primarily policy-driven and not delivering a direct program. A little history about the revenue in the governor's office. There are three primary funding sources: general fund, lottery fund, and then other funds. The general fund is primarily spent with policy staff. There's also expenditures in the executive appointments, and the arrest and return program is partially general funded. Lottery funds, as mentioned before, is intergovernmental relations and regional solutions, not just working at the state level, but also at the local level as well. There are two assessments that are assessed on state agencies that fund the Diversity and Inclusion Program, formerly known as Affirmative Action, and then the Economic and Business Equity Program, which would have it had a long alphabet soup: emerging small businesses, minorities, and women. And I know I'm butchering that. I apologize. It is much easier for me to remember it as Economic and Business Equity. As Mr. Hill mentioned, we do receive other funds from state agencies to help help fund the constituent services. So when a citizen of Oregon has an issue that they would like resolved with state government, they oftentimes contact the governor's office directly. So we take care of, we handle their phone calls and letters and make correspondence with them and get back to them on the issues. There's workforce
Mr.
policy.
DeForest, yes. One moment, please, Senator Johnson.
This is just a forum for me to make the plea that when the governor's office is handling constituent services, having a tracking mechanism to alert legislators that you are working with our constituents in our individual jurisdictions is incredibly helpful. In some cases, as you know, Mr. Shipley, from your prior service in the building, folks reach out everywhere, and it would just be nice to know if the your ombudsman or your constituent service is dealing with our folks.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Thank you for that point. And absolutely, that some of the work that the constituent services team in the governor's office has done just in the last couple of years at kind of modernizing the systems and developing a database for tracking communications could enable us to do some more of that. So we'll look into that functionality. Yeah.
One other point is that I think it is an efficiency measure as well. I was working on an issue this morning with a constituent. They don't need a legislator. They need a lawyer. And the question has now been asked and answered. If they're dissatisfied with the answer I've given them and they start the portfolio again new in your office, we're having somebody expend time to get to a point. I've already worked with the agency head. There is no fix to this problem. And I think that two-way communication would be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, good point, Senator. Thank you. It's an interesting question. If you have tracking capability, it'd be interesting to see if there's a way to link that more efficiently and bidirectionally, because there's, you know, you're talking about you have a tracking system, but there's no way for our offices specifically to let you know what constituent issues we've worked on. I mean, there's no reason to dump all of it on the governor's office, but it'd be an interesting question to think about offline. Senator Johnson, I'm glad you brought that point up, as usual. So, okay. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. I want to talk a little about risk management. It's my understanding that the governor's office uses DAS risk management for its insurance needs. The last summer, the DAS risk management made a policy change to include a criminal defense of certain selected public employees and officials that had where their charges might have both a dual and a civil component. It was just a policy change that they would defend these people up to about $35,000 a year, or $35,000 per case. So if the criminal defense of the former governor and his first lady or other employees of the governor is required, will the cost be borne by risk management, or will it be borne by the governor's office, or how will that be handled?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I will have to get back with you with an answer for that. I am not certain of what the answer is.
Okay. Well, if I could add a little to that question, in today's Oregonian article by Nick Budnick says that the former Oregon First Lady Silver Hayes wants the state to pay her legal costs for fighting to keep secret her state-related emails. So in your response, maybe you could include how that will be handled as well.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Whitsitt, certainly.
Thank you.
As you can see, there are several different activities that are funded by other agencies. At the bottom of the list is one that I'm reminded of every biennium. The extradition program, the arrest and return program, also receives some other funds, especially as related to child support. Key performance measures for the governor's office, there are five. I'm not going to read through each one of them, but they do cover the customer satisfaction. We do have requests for modifications to the customer satisfaction measure, and also number three, the Oregon fugitives returned. And then you can see that the other measures there. In the arena of certified industrial sites, the governor's office actually came in above target for the number of industrial sites prepared. However, continues to fall a little short on number four and number five in the state contracting awards and in state hiring.
Senator Johnson, and then Representative Coacher Smith.
I've done this budget for a number of years, and number three has always perplexed me. That is, in some cases, beyond Oregon's ability to control. And while I am generally not a fan of changing performance measures, particularly when agencies have not lived up to the performance expectations. But in this instance, I think that that might be one that we would want to revisit. There are so many external factors, and I don't know why that becomes a performance measure attributable to the governor or her staff. And I just am holding open my willingness to take a look at a different measure.
It baffled me 2 years ago when I first was on this committee. For this as well. So it'd be nice to know the historical context of that and why that is. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me either. Thank you, Senator Johnson. Co-Chair Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Colleagues, professionally, I do economic development for a living, and I really, really want to compliment the executive branch and Business Oregon and many of those other folks on the certified industrial sites. We do work over in Malheur County. And you know, a few terms back, you would hear Representative Benz talk about the need for additional industrial land. And I have to share with you, a team of folks really came together and have been excellent in solving that problem. And so, you know, I don't know what the survey is going to look like, but I know there's one big smiley face from Representative Benz in Malheur County. So well done.
Excellent. Thank you. Anything else?
The last two slides are really the suggested changes to the key performance measures on customer satisfaction, looking for a change that really reflects the activities of the regional solutions team, and that they keep their plans updated on an annual basis. Currently, we're not necessarily measuring it on an annual basis, but really should be accountable that we are sticking to that schedule.
Senator Johnson.
If I understood what you just said, that they update their priority lists on an annual basis, I just want to share with you that I think Northwest Oregon has one of the most robust business plans of any of them. Some of the projects that we're working on are very long term. On our business plan, for example, we have a number of projects that cost multiple millions of dollars, $40 million to rebuild the Vernonia schools. We still have a little tiny piece to close there. So if we are going to update them on an annual basis, I think that there needs to be some mechanism to reflect that these are ongoing projects. And in the original iteration of Regional Solutions, those groups were cut loose to go find their own funding. They were to find it not provided out of the general fund, which I think led to have projects roll over year after year. So if you're intending to count how fast things move off a work plan, I would commend for your consideration our work plan in Northwest Oregon to see how complicated and of what long duration some of our projects are.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, that's an excellent point. In very many cases, these are going to be multiple-year projects, and I think just an update on the status of the project will be sufficient for some, but I think that that's a great conversation to have.
Other questions? Okay.
And finally, the suggested change on number 3 would be to eliminate it.
You're precious, Senator.
However, this is certainly open to a much broader discussion. And that is the end of my presentation.
Okay. Other questions? Mr. Shipley, anything else you'd like to add to the conversation?
No. Thank you very much, Madam Co-Chair.
Gentlemen, do we have any public testimony? Ms. Jensen? No? Okay. No public testimony. We're wrapping up early. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5021 on the governor's office. Is there any other business before the committee today? Tomorrow we have, I don't remember. Employment Relations Board will be working their budget, so we do need I can't remember. We had so many confusions with them. No, just public hearing tomorrow?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought we were going to have them, and then theirs was one of the ones that got canceled when people weren't long. So I take it back. Tomorrow, public testimony on the Employment Relations Board. Anything else, ladies and gentlemen? Public testimony on the Employment Relations Board. Anything else, ladies and gentlemen?